Hello, everyone. It's Space Cafe podcast time, and my name is Marcus. So, 2 years ago, I was working on an interesting project, a once-in-a-lifetime project, one could even say. Young German startup PTS was planning on sending a rover to the moon to rendezvous with Apollo 17. Apollo 17 has been the last human expedition to the moon so far. A plaque left on the moon by the astronauts reads, "Here man completed his first exploration of the moon, December 1972 AD. May the spirit of peace in which he came be reflected in the lives of all mankind." Yeah, and this plaque is still up there, to this day. All right, so those guys from Berlin wanted to go back to this historic site and take a look, because hey, why not? My task in all of this was to help set up a communication strategy. And one day, when we were talking about camera angles during the big moment, someone came up with an innocent question. How close could we actually get our cameras to the original landing site? At that moment, we knew we had entered dangerous territory, because that was a dangerous question. How close to any historic site can you go? I mean, like, if push comes to shove, chances are we could roll over the historic tire tracks in the lunar dust. And that in turn could potentially produce one or two phone calls, starting with a 1 as the international dialing code. Before we could find a proper answer, the mission came to a premature end for many reasons. However, the original question has not changed ever since. How close to any historic site on the moon can you go? And who owns the moon in the first place? Quite a bit has changed over the past 2 years, and the moon has intensified its gravitational pull on human curiosity. Tomorrow's moon missions are already being assembled in countless laboratories and workshops all over the place. The calm before the storm is coming to an end, and we better have some rules in place soon to make sure the tire tracks up there are kept from our own curiosity. Today with me on the show is the person who dedicated her professional life to seek and most of all bring clarity into all of this.
That's right.
And it seems that she's the one who might have all the cards in her hands to save our past for an indefinite future. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michelle Hanlon. Okay, Michelle, can I call you a space lawyer? Would that be the proper professional title for you?
That's what I call myself. I absolutely introduce myself to people as a space lawyer, and I get a lot of strange looks for that, but I'll take them.
So, did you coin that term, or have there been any space lawyers around?
Well, there have been space lawyers since the, 50s and 60s, absolutely. And space needs lawyers. So, if you're interested in law or, the humanities, and we really need to have more and more people understand the laws that govern us in space and how we need to regulate activities in space.
So is it fair to say that space is in a situation where it needs legal attention, right?
Absolutely. And I think, this summer has been a very demonstrable of that, because you had the President Trump saying space is not a global commons. And then you had pushback from the Outer Space Institute asking their government, the Canadian government, to push back and say, no, space is a global commons. And then you have the Artemis Accords, which are bilateral efforts to govern space activities. And you have the international community pushing back and saying, no, it should be multilateral. The bottom line is everybody understands we need to start thinking about how we are going to protect different areas on other celestial bodies, primarily the moon, because we're all going back. And unfortunately, we're not going back as one, we're going back as 3, 4, 5, who knows how many separate nations and entities.
To be honest, I never really understood the term global commons, so I looked it up. UN.org defines global commons as, "Global commons have been traditionally defined as those parts of the planet that fall outside national jurisdiction and to which all nations have access. International law identifies four global commons, namely the high seas, the atmosphere, the Antarctica, and the outer space. Okay, understood. On with the show. So to put that very bluntly, the question is, who owns the moon, right?
Exactly. And the answer is very simple. Nobody. So the question then, and then that under law, nobody. And so when you think about it, it makes sense from a sort of, oh, of course, the moon is for everyone. We all live under the moon. We've all look at the moon. But when you talk about landing on the moon and trying to do science on the moon, you know, whether you're going to use it to figure out how Earth began, or whether you're going to mine the moon for space resources, there's no body to say, yes, you can go over there, or you can go over there. We don't have anybody. If you don't own the moon, you can't manage the moon.
Is this somewhat comparable to the old West, like the way we're told it happened back in the day?
So, I mean, of course, with one big difference, the old West had Indians on it, you know, Native Americans. Right. And so.
But they were ignored away. So, unfortunately.
I mean, so the I like to liken it to Polynesians. So you think about the South Seas Islands, the Polynesians looked out across the horizon. They didn't see another island in sight. All they saw was water. But yet they decided, you know what? We're going to build a boat and we're going to go out across that horizon and disappear and see what happens. And to them, it was endless. And they found islands that didn't have populations and they populated those islands. And so I look at our exploration of space in that way. You know, we don't. Hopefully someday we'll meet aliens, but I don't think it's going to be in my lifetime or anytime soon. You know, I think we have plenty of space to explore without bumping into another civilization. So
not yet. So
not yet.
Before we talk about what's going on in space right now, let's move back in time a little bit. And so when did you first think that you need to become a space lawyer in order to take care of the moon?
So I'm the classic space nerd. I grew up with Star Trek. My mother's Chinese. And so, you know, I saw Sulu was sort of and Uhura, you know, it was in many ways, I related to that world very much. I also grew up as a Foreign Service brat. I moved every 2 to 3 years, always constantly surrounded by a very diverse international culture. Then I got to school and, you know, sort of realized, wow, I have to make money and I have to feed myself. And so I became a lawyer, which I love. And I was 25 years a business attorney. I was helping a lot of businesses, mostly mergers and acquisitions. And then after 25 years, I have two sons who are aerospace engineers and they were just doing really interesting stuff. And I started proofing their research and realizing, wow, you know, one of my sons built a cube satellite with robotic arms because as a precursor to work on orbit servicing.
And you must have been pretty influential on your kids.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I think it's vice versa. I think, you know, we spurred the love of space in each other and robotics. My younger son would say more robotics, but I learned about orbital debris through my son and I went back to school to deal with the debris issue. I thought, you know, okay, we need cleaner orbits. That was going to be my cause célèbre. I was going to really focus on that. I had done enough in the business world. I was ready to give back. I got to school and that fall, Jan Werner was in China and he had a meeting with the Chinese space agency. And, you know, he's talking about a moon village. And he said in this press conference, well, we must go back to the moon together, if only to take down those American flags. You know, and he said, I'm joking, of course. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, he's joking, but what can you do that? And that's when I did the research and realized, wow, you can. There's a huge gap in international law and there's nothing protecting any of the heritage on the moon, you know, from Luna 2, which was a Soviet spacecraft, the first ever human made object to impact another celestial body, and Luna 9, which is the first soft landing on the moon and produced some of the first pictures of from the moon's surface that we have. So I'm not just talking about Apollo. I'm talking about 110 different sites on the moon that have evidence of human activity on them.
110 sites.
Wow, there are 110 sites on the moon that have. Wow. Yeah. I mean, there were 28 Luna missions. There were 6 Apollo missions, plus Surveyor, Ranger, you know, Chang, Beresheet, Chandrayaan. ESA has one spacecraft on the moon. Mm-hmm. JAXA has several. Mm-hmm. So now I'm not saying, oh, everything that's on the moon can't be touched, but I think we have a real opportunity here to protect certain things that should be protected. And also we need to manage the protection because we don't want just anybody going back to Apollo 17 and, you know, just taking things. If we are going to allow people to approach the site, we want those first people to be scientists and engineers, you know, who are going to look at, see what happened and learn from all of that.
The more I think about this, the more interesting it gets. I mean, provided I had the technical ability to go to the moon, and from what I've seen so far during my work with PT scientists, it is becoming ever more possible to build your own off-the-shelf backyard moon rover. Technology has advanced hugely ever since the Apollo days, when those guys had to invent everything from scratch. Today we build on their shoulders and can advance ever more rapidly. So, provided I could put together my own little mission and bring a rover with a robot arm to Apollo 11, could I haul it back and put it up in my backyard just because?
So, the one thing, under the Outer Space Treaty, any object that a country launches into space remains under the jurisdiction and control of that object, okay, of that nation. So, just because it's in space doesn't mean it doesn't belong to the United States anymore. So, yes, you would be sued by the United States to get their object back. But you know,
I would have to bring it back to the moon then.
Yes. I think they might take delivery at the Smithsonian, I don't know. But when you think about it, cuz in 2017 Sotheby's auctioned off the first moon bag. So it's a moon bag carried by Neil Armstrong with the very first samples of lunar dust in it. It fell out of the control of NASA and ended up in the hands of a private individual. The NASA sued to get the bag back, and the judge, looking at the control of it, the judge said, basically, you could, when you read the opinion, you can almost hear the judge crying, you know, like, NASA, I don't know how you did it, but you lost this bag and it now belongs to this private individual.
Wow. I can't do anything about it.
Yeah. And so she sold the bag for $2.4 million. So that's just a bag with a little bit of lunar dust in it. So you don't need to bring back the whole LEM and sell it. You know, you could grab the plaque and just take anything from the site and bring it back and sell it. Poop bags, exactly. You know, and so you think about it and, you know, people say, well, that wouldn't happen. We're watching, but you know, we're talking about being 10 or 15 years from actually going back and forth to the moon quite a bit, a lot of different entities doing it. And so if NASA can lose the first moon bag with the first moon sample collected by the first moonwalker, imagine what they could lose sight of if we're going back and if a lot of different missions are going back and forth to the moon. Absolutely. And so that's really frightening. And they're not considered artifacts. And so, yes, the U.S. could sue you to get it back, but it wouldn't be covered by any of our cultural heritage regimes in the U.S. or, you know, trade and artifacts or anything like that. And we believe they should be.
I think it should be clear by now that something needs to be done here. After 25 years of successful work as a lawyer, Michelle decided to go back to school to wrap her head around space law because she knew that she will not only need all the support she can get, but also need to know everything the world has ever produced about this tricky legal hole.
So I went and I earned my LLM, which is sort of a master's. We have a JD and then a master's in space law from McGill University. And I'm proud to say now I'm the co-director of the same type of program, a space law program at the University of Mississippi. So there are 4 or 5 universities around the world that offer directed space law or air and space law higher degrees. And it's really important to get that instruction in space law because you can read the treaties, but to really immerse for a year on understanding all of the background and history in those treaties, there's not very much space law. And so there's a lot of ways to interpret it and there's a lot of gaps. And so there's a lot of different ways to think about it. And, you know, fundamentally, it's just really fun for a lawyer after you've been told the rules, the rules, wow. the rules. And now we're like, oh, there's no rules. Hey, what should we do?
It's hunting season for lawyers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And, you know, that scares a lot of people, but it shouldn't. I know a lot of commercial industry, oh, we don't want lawyers. They always slow things down. But, you know, good lawyers make things easier for you. And I think it's really important if you're going back to the moon or if you want to do something on the moon, you have to understand what the rules are. We have to get rules because right now your investors are saying, well, I don't know. What if China decides they own the moon when we lose our investment?
I'm asking myself, who wouldn't think so on Earth? So who wouldn't be on your side?
Agreed. I've never met anybody who said, oh, that's a bad idea. But there are people who are very worried about overreach. And so people say, well, does that mean everything that goes to the moon, if it's a national first, that's heritage? What do you mean by heritage? And that's what we really need to focus on. Is people are really worried that Far Moon Khan wants to turn the moon into some big conservation site, you know, and you can't develop anything. And a lot of concern in Canada, for example, you know, the people feel like the indigenous people have stopped and blocked development, you know, because of their traditions and so forth. So there's a way to balance it. And that's all we're looking for, is to balance development and protection. And I also like to point out, you know, there are sites that when you protect them or preserve them, it doesn't mean you can't move anything. You know, we want to get back. We want to take pictures. Mm-hmm. I always talk about, you know, if you build a road in England, you're always running into some dead king, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't stop the road from being built, right? Right. You stop, you take pictures, you figure out who he is, you move the bones carefully, and then you build the road. And so, you know, arguably, I would say a Tranquility Base ought to remain pristine, but maybe the Luna 2020 site doesn't need to, or maybe, you know, maybe Surveyor 4 doesn't need to be protected. You know, there are those 110 sites. I don't think all 110 things need to have walls built around them and nobody can approach them.
A quick disclaimer. Tranquility Base is the site on the moon where in July 1969, humans landed and walked on another celestial body for the first time. Do you have a personal favorite remnant on the moon?
That's a really good question. I've never been asked that. Favorite remnant on the moon. I mean, it's so fun to think about all the stuff that's up there, right? The golf ball. I think it's also fun to think about the stuff that we don't know if it's up there or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you saw the movie First Man. You know, did Neil Armstrong drop his daughter's bracelet there? Apollo 12 was supposed to have a ceramic tile with artwork on it. You know, we don't really know if it's there or not. There's been a whole PBS TV show about it. I think, though, I would say my favorite thing left behind would be the medals of the cosmonauts that Neil and Buzz took with them of their own personal choice, because to me that really signifies, more than the plaques, more than the messages of peace, to take the medals of, you know, your sworn enemy at the time and bring them with you is such a sign of respect and such a sign of understanding that even though we were racing to the moon, you know, they died in a human effort to get to the moon. And wow. I think it's just really special that our men, our humans, the American humans, were able to recognize that and cross that bridge for us.
Our listeners cannot see this, but you, Michelle, can see it. Goosebumps right here, right now. Thank you so much for that beautiful story, which is not a story. It's a fact, in fact.
Yeah.
So things are starting to speed up for Michelle and her husband. And while she's still back at school, their brainchild, For All Moonkind, is born. A non-governmental, non-profit, and entirely volunteer international organization to manage the preservation of history and human heritage in outer space.
My mentor at McGill, Ram Jakhu, who is also world-renowned space lawyer, agreed to join our leadership board, as did Joe Pelton, who is a space policy advisor from George Washington University, also really well-respected in the space community. And I was so honored that they decided to join and support my effort that I finished my thesis as fast as I could so I could come out onto the stage. And we actually announced our existence publicly when Sotheby's auctioned off that bag, because we just think it's a travesty that we lost it.
Nice move. But from its inception onward, for all mankind was destined to be a race against the clock.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's running out. The moon is going to get crowded a lot faster than we think. And so I think we have about a decade. I mean, the moon is not tiny either. And from what I've seen, most of the missions are going away from where the Apollo sites are and most of the Luna sites. And so, you know, do we have 10, 15 years before we have to worry about a bad actor going back? I think probably 10, 15 years, because what really scares us is what we talked about earlier. That bag got $2.4 million. So think about the funding you can do for a space company if you manage to get up to Apollo 11 and grab a poop bag or the olive branch or even just some of the regolith, right? And bring it back to Earth. Imagine what that would sell for. Imagine how much more you could promote your space exploration companies. So that's, we're racing against, again, not so much China's going to go and topple over the Eagle, but against that bad actor. So when a commercial entity and not Astrobotic, not Moon Express, not iSpace, I mean, those are all of those companies I'm confident would protect and respect our heritage. But there's soon going to be a company that's not, you know, human nature is human nature. So that's what we're racing against. And that timing is very hard to gauge. But I would say, you know, we need the international community to really focus on this within this decade.
So if supposedly there's a bad actor doing his thing on the moon, without a legal framework, you couldn't even hold that company or person liable here on Earth, right? So he could do whatever he wants.
He or she.
thank you for that.
So if somebody were to go and take Charlie Duke's photo, you know, he has the photo of his family on the moon, and take that and bring it back. As a lawyer, I think I could make a good argument that that's a space object that belongs to the United States. We could sue to get return of the object and so forth. But that's assuming that it gets sold to somebody that you can track in a country that you have a treaty with to be able to litigate and bring somebody back. But what we have absolutely no protection for are the boot prints. Anybody could go and just erase that first boot print. Just poof, and no recourse whatsoever.
Can you believe that? Imagine you're accidentally running over those prints while unloading your brand new regolith-proof Cybertruck from the docking bay of your brand new CyberLam.
Nobody owns land on the moon, so you can't say you ruined my property. It's not a space object. You know, it's a moon imprint. And so that's, you know, people think, oh, well, just sweep it under the rug. Who cares? Whatever. But you think about it. About 20 years ago, we discovered in Laetoli, Tanzania, footprints that we think are the very first sign that humans walked upright from 3.5 million years ago. And why is that significant? Because, you know, when you walk upright, that frees your hands to do stuff like build tools and everything. So we only discovered those 20 years ago. They were made 3.5 million years ago. And we protect them. We preserve, you know, only a certain number of people can see them each year, so forth. We know exactly where these boot prints are. We know exactly why they're there. We know how they got there. And we have the opportunity to protect them. We don't want 3.5 million years from now, people digging around on the moon thinking, oh, where'd that boot print go? Wouldn't it be cool to find it? Yeah. And so I just think, and like I said, I think it's so inspiring, especially because we haven't been back in 50 years. It shows just how ridiculously amazing that feat was. We had no business putting humans on the moon in 1969. None whatsoever. We haven't been able to repeat it since. So, well, and since 1972. So that feat, I think that blueprint just shows the innovation and persistence and just the incredible awesomeness of the human species. And that blueprint shows what we can do if, you know, at that time we were at war. Imagine if we weren't focused on war, we were actually focused on getting ourselves out there. What we could do, it'd be amazing. And so to me,
if we worked together.
Yeah, exactly. And so to me, that blueprint inspires all of that. And I would just think if somebody were to just go up and erase it, think about what vandals do right now to cultural heritage sites on Earth, you know, and those are protected already. This is something that would just be a travesty. I want I want the next generation and the generations after that to be able to go, and we'll figure out a way to build a museum mm-hmm. or protect the site somehow. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet, but boy, mm-hmm. we have to.
So how can one protect those sites on the moon? You can't police those things on the moon unless you build a police station up there.
So we almost have, you know, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter orbits the moon. And so mm-hmm. there are some fantastic pictures. You can, which is another thing that I love, is the LRO has pictures. You can actually see the astronaut footpaths. So we know the footprints are,
where would I go?
It's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter mm-hmm. website. I think I plug in LRO or Lunar Reconnaissance mm-hmm. Orbiter, and then they'll show you, and they have, you see the rover tracks, you don't see boot prints, but you see their paths that they took. You know, you can see where they walked. You can trace all their walks.
So the moon landing was not fake, Michelle?
I know. We have evidence. Yeah. And the Earth is round.
Interesting. Wow. So that must have a huge resolution then.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. And it's only going to get better. So how do we protect them? NASA has guidelines, which sort of say they're just recommendations. They're not enforceable by law. It's one of the things we're working to make law. But they say, if you're going to land on the moon, please don't land closer than 2 kilometers to the mm-hmm. site. Because mm-hmm. the plume effect, you know, the regolith on the moon is really damaging. So that's one way to protect them, is to build sort of safety zones around them. The other thing.
But I'm sorry, do spacefaring nations on Earth talk to one another prior to moon missions, where they will land, where they would land?
So under the Outer Space Treaty, Article 9 says if there is a chance that you would harm, your activities would harmfully interfere with the activities of another state, you should consult with that state. And so that's not a law that says you have to. And also, we don't really know what harmful interference means. And again, for an operational, you know, if the U.S. were going to go near Chang'e 4, you know, there would be operational concerns. You don't want to get too near because you don't want to ruin their equipment. But with heritage, with artifacts, they're not operable anymore. And so is it really harmfully interfering if you accidentally sandblast them under the Outer Space mm-hmm. Treaty? No, mm-hmm. you know, it's not. So I think the moon, I honestly don't know the answer to your question. I don't work at state or NASA, and I've never thought to ask it. But the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space is a great place for the nations to come together and talk about what they're doing in space. And so civilian missions, certainly people will talk, and there is sharing, believe it or not, mm-hmm. the scientific community, even with the US and China, they're sharing information. They're transparent. And so if there's nothing formal, at least at this point, I think that the moon is big enough that we are able to stay far enough away from each other. But the problem is, there are some, like the 2 or 3 areas of the moon that are of particular scientific interest. And I think those are going to get very conflicted very fast.
So in the meantime, Michelle and her husband's little project was growing. Michelle had her degree under her belt and was ready to go full steam with the project.
So as I said, I was a business attorney, and I'm used to making deals. And I'm used to making deals and closing them within 2 or 3 months. And so I thought, we're going to create a convention on protecting heritage in outer space, and we're going to get it done in time for 2019, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. Mm. And then I met the international community and the realities of public international law. We wanted to create an entity where people could support the effort. And so that's where we actually had For All Mankind. And then I was invited to go to the Committee on Peaceful Use of Outer Space. And I realized that that was where I needed to be to push this effort.
By the way, what Michelle means when she talks about the Committee of the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space is a highly official institution of the United Nations, where Michelle's little project got an equally official observer status.
And we became a permanent observer to the committee, and that is where we focus our attention right now. We are about 100 attorneys from around the world working on different ways to establish this convention, this new treaty. So we're looking at, I realized, okay, it's going to take 10 or 15 years to have a new treaty. We haven't had a treaty in space mm-hmm. since the mm-hmm. 70s. Mm-hmm. Preservation is the only way we're going to get a new treaty in space, because here on Earth, every nation in the world has ratified the World Heritage Convention. So we understand how important preservation is. And you even said earlier, who was against this idea? Nobody. So we believe we can harness that protection, that preservation, that cultural heritage, and bring it into space with us as a foundation, not just to protect our heritage, but to also promote collaboration in space and recognize that we're one human species. And so we created this entity that could that people could identify with, and that's why we're Moonkind. And the people, we are looking at protecting all heritage in all of outer space. And so people say, well, you're called Moonkind, so why? That would be just the moon. But we believe that the cradle of our spacefaring civilization is the moon. And so as we expand into space, our progeny will be Moonkind, because they'll go from the moon into the outer reaches of space. But so we created this institution in order to be able to have a voice at the UN. And in other places, we also have a voice in the U.S. Congress. We were able to get a bill passed through the Senate.
All right, a quick break here. In the meantime, Michelle's dream has become the most vocal and important voice for the preservation of cultural heritage on the moon. How does that feel?
It's amazing. It passed last year on the 50th anniversary, the One Small Step to Protect Human Heritage, passed unanimously in the Senate. Unfortunately, it's just sitting in the House right now. And I think everyone's focused on other things. But, you know, we keep hoping that it'll be resuscitated and get passed and signed. But no, and the new Artemis Accords, which are NASA and State Department's sort of principles for bilateral agreements to explore space, they include heritage. It's the first time ever that a international treaty about space has even mentioned heritage. So we take credit for that as well.
There's so many things I like about that story, but what I really like, and I think this is super encouraging to all of our listeners out there, that whatever idea you have, something big can grow out of it, potentially, if you're super dedicated to it. And so there's potential for a lot of good ideas out there, I guess.
Absolutely. And I will say, I agree completely. When I was new to the whole UN experience, the COPUS opened their arms to us. This is, you know, we talk in the United States about the government being the people's house and the White House is the people's house and it's about the people. You know, that's the way the COPUS works too. They recognize that they're delegates of nations there, but they're representing people. And so it's one of my greatest frustrations that more people aren't involved in space. Like we need to educate the public so much more about how important space is, how every single thing you do is affected by space, and build better coalitions to support politicians who want to explore space. But it's just, but yes, I agree with you completely. And I tell my students all the time at Mississippi, you know, I am one person. My husband actually, you know, has to really work for a living because somebody has to support us. And I've gotten 100 people to volunteer for me. And I'm working with some of the greatest space minds, space law minds, and preservation law minds in the world. I get students volunteering all the time because we believe in this, and people are listening to us. The State Department listened to us.
So how about the younger generations? How do they react to that?
It's interesting because the most interest I get are from upper high school and young college students. We're working with students right now from Mexico, from Colombia, from Brazil, from
Italy,
encouraging. From Sweden, that people understand. I think that one of the most important things that I learned is the bootprints inspire so many people. And even though Americans tend to think of it as an American achievement, the whole world thinks of it as a human achievement. Everybody does.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, yeah. And it's just so heartening to me. And it makes my job that much easier because, you know, there's not one, you know, we have students from South Africa who reached out to me. What can we do to help? You know, Ghana, Botswana. And because everybody recognizes that that was the first step, And we've got a lot of squabbles going on here on Earth, but we'll figure them out. And I tell my students, you are the ones who are going to figure this out, because we don't have much more time to work it out before we implode.
Say, so what do you think, what are the next critical steps for all moonkind?
So we're right now working on, as I said, a manual that will compare space law and preservation law and look at all the things that need to be considered. And we want to convene a summit in probably May or June of next year, where we bring the greatest minds together, hopefully into a room, not a Zoom room, where we can talk things out. And then we will hand to the UN COPUS a manual that will talk. It's not going to say what the treaty should look like. It's just going to say, these are all the issues we've identified. These are the different ways we can solve each issue. And these are our recommendations. And so that's our next step. We're also working on cataloging all of the human material on the moon. We're working with a Canadian company to basically create a digital registry of all the items. And so that's underway right now.
Nice. Beautiful. If Moon Village were looking for its first citizens, would you be one of them?
Absolutely. No doubt whatsoever. I think my sons are grown. My husband would probably stay here, but you know, we could Zoom all the time.
Do you talk about those things?
We do. Yeah. He absolutely would stay on Earth. There's no question about it. He gets claustrophobic. Yeah. But I would give anything to go to the moon.
So you could sort of set up your legal spin-off on the moon. And
that's right.
So you could like do business over the internet.
Yeah. I could be the first real space lawyer, right? Yeah.
So what do you think? This is a critical question. I keep asking to as many space experts as possible, because I'm really keen on finding out where we are as humanity right now in this moment in time. Do you think that we are right now in a moment as humanity where we are finally ready to leave Earth for good, to make the big leap? Is this the moment? Because 1969 wasn't the moment. So what do you think?
So first I would say, I don't think humanity is leaving Earth for good. I think certain of our species will leave Earth for good. But one of the reasons that space exploration is so important is because of all the ways it can help life on Earth. And one of my big sort of visions, grand dreams, is actually moving heavy industry off of Earth so that we can return Earth to the pristine environment it was pre-industrialization. And so yes, I think we are on the cusp of we are on this threshold, and we really have an opportunity to take this next giant leap together and not as different sovereign nations. And that's really what the foundational reason for the existence of For All Moonkind is, to figure out how to unify the human species once and for all, because it would be tragic if, maybe I just grew up with too much science fiction, but you know, the sad thing is, or the hurdle is Star Trek just came to be, right? Gene Roddenberry didn't write how we got to be to Star Trek. And so we've got to figure that part ourselves.
How to get there. So Michelle, one last question, because these times, especially when it comes to COVID, rising sea levels and climate mayhem and mass migration and whatnot. So we are very often confronted with the question, why invest in stuff like that? Why go to the moon and not take care of our shit here on Earth? So what would you answer to those people?
We don't know what's out there, and we don't know what we can find out there that can help us here on Earth. So we found, what have we found in the Amazon rainforest? Drugs that help cure us, you know. So we can't turn inward, because we don't have the resources we need to fix everything on Earth right now, whether it's more space, no pun intended, or, you know, more kinds of ways to use in situ resources. You know, a lot of the things that we do in space, we harness to use on Earth to make life better for people on Earth. And, you know, NASA publishes a book each year, a catalog of all of the technologies that have been harnessed that they produced and they let people use for free to create things that we use on Earth. And it's everything from like the gold paint on the Oscars, Academy Awards, you know, to the paint that is used on highways now that, you know, so they're reflective. All those things were developed either in space or for the space program. So we have this boundless horizon of opportunity. We can't turn our back on it. And I will say also, you know, in this time of COVID, when one thing that I've learned and, you know, all the media aside is what is keeping us going? You know, we're all holed up in our homes, but we're not. We're reaching out to each other all the time. Mm-hmm. We're on more Zoom conversations and conferences.
Right.
I've been to more events than I would have if it had been real life. And so we're still reaching out to each other. We're still a community and we're still finding, you know, I've met neighbors I hadn't met before and we're buying groceries for each other and we're sharing kindnesses and persistences. And I have the Journal of Space Law. All our libraries were closed, so I couldn't actually check the sources. You know, as an editor, you have to make sure. And so my authors all found their sources and sent them to me. You know, we came together in such a beautiful way in this time. And I know the media plays up all of the bad stories, but there are so many good stories. And this time has really given me the most hope for the future than I've ever had.
Thank you so much. That's a beautiful way to end our show. We've almost been talking for an hour now, so time is fleeing. I have one last question. We do have a fun tradition at the end of our shows, and this show, as you know, is called Space Cafe Podcast. And if you go to coffee places, sometimes you love to have an espresso. And so my question to you, what would be your space-related or science-related story that comes to your mind without much thinking? So what kind of story would you like to share with us?
So I think I'm going to harken back to history. And because we are, you know, in the week of the 51st anniversary of Apollo 11, and it strikes me, you know, you were surprised that there are 110 sites with human stuff on the moon. We've done a lot of stuff on the moon. But one thing that really surprises people is that while Neil and Buzz were on the moon, the Soviets landed a Luna spacecraft on the 21st. Yeah, a robotic, while they were on the moon, the Soviet Union landed a robot on the moon as well. The point was the Soviet Union was trying to get back to the moon and have a return mission, bring moon rocks back before the U.S. got humans on the moon. So that at least they could say, well, we got the moon rocks back first. And
wow.
So, yeah. And so you think about that competition and
absolutely.
To me, it's incredible. And when you think about those two space agencies, you know, doing those things, imagine if they were together. I also tell people a lot, you know, why did the U.S. win? I'm not going to call it win the space race. The Soviets got Sputnik up but how did the United States get the first humans on the moon? It's because of our diversity. And that's something that's also so important today. You know, they weren't played up, but we are a nation of immigrants. And maybe they were a lot of white immigrants at the time, but they were also black. We know that now, you know, from Hidden Figures. And it's that diversity that is going to propel humanity. And that's the diversity that we have to embrace. And it's a diversity that I hope we can embrace. And then, you know, we're not landing competing spacecraft on the moon next time.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle.
Well, thank you.
To all our listeners, if you would like to learn more about For All Moonkind, more about Michelle, please do go to our website, spacewatch.global. If you would like to share your ideas or your stories, please do send us a message at podcast@spacewatch.global. And other than that, thank you so much for taking the time, Michelle. That's highly appreciated because you are a very, very busy person with very critical and important stuff to do. So highly appreciated.
I appreciate the time so much. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Marcus. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. To you listeners, I'm super happy that you are still listening to our show. It's a growing number of people, and this is still a very young show, so please keep spreading the word, and please tune in again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.